Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy. I'm Rob Wolf, and thank you for joining me. I'm excited to welcome Ken Liu to the podcast. Ken is the winner of Hugo, Nebula, and World Fantasy Awards for his short stories, but we're not going to be talking about short stories. Today, we're going to be talking about a book Ken translated, The Three-Body Problem, and a book he wrote, The Grace of Kings. I'm so glad you can join me today, Ken.
Thank you, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start with The Three-Body Problem, which is by best-selling Chinese author Cuxin Liu and has been nominated for a Nebula. And I'm sure your translation had a lot to do with its recognition here in the English-speaking world. As I understand it, there are not a lot of Chinese science fiction novels that get translated into English. Is that right?
I believe that's right. Well, I know that's right. The question is somewhat complicated by the fact that terms like Chinese and science fiction are all somewhat in contention. So I will say that The Three-Body Problem is the first hard sci-fi novel by an author from the People's Republic of China to be translated into English. And it is quite a milestone.
Wow. And it's actually becomes a series of three. So it's a trilogy that has been translated.
That's right. The second volume is being done by Joel Martinson, and I'm doing the third volume. The second volume is actually coming out this July. So if you like The Three-Body Problem, be sure to pick up The Dark Forest.
Well, tell me how the project came about and how you got involved with it.
So The Three-Body Problem is sort of a publishing phenomenon in China. Hard sci-fi science fiction novels, and basically even sci-fi novels, have not historically done well in China. I mean, this is all relative. They sell in numbers that would be the envy of any author here in the English speaking world. But in China, the numbers are you have to sort of multiply everything by a factor of 5 to 10 to get the same sort of equivalent. So science fiction, even though it was selling big numbers for us, for the Chinese audience and the Chinese publishing industry, was considered sort of a niche genre. The Three-Body Problem, however, kind of broke through that. After Liu Cixin sort of wrote the three books and got them published, each volume sold better than the previous one, and ultimately became a bestseller. Over 400,000 copies of the set have been sold, and those are just the official numbers. The actual number of readers is probably bigger as books get passed from people to people, and I don't know if that number accounts for ebook copies and so on. So it's truly a bestseller by any standard, and it sort of revitalized the Chinese science fiction industry. I think there have been more science fiction books, both translated and by Chinese authors, being published in China after the success of The Three-Body Problem. So it's all around a very cool, something to be celebrated. I got involved because I read the books and I thought they were really cool. But, you know, I've done some translations before, but mostly of short fiction. And I didn't think I would have an opportunity to do a novel because, as you note, it's very rare for a novel from any country to be translated into English. I think our published market has only 1-2% published works, translated works. So, you know, that was a very remote kind of opportunity. But then a publishing company in China called China Educational Publishing Import and Export Company, CEPIEC. I'm not sure I got the total name right, but the acronym is CEPIEC. They bought up the foreign rights to the trilogy, and then they wanted to bring it to the English market. They ended up partnering with Tor Books, and they approached me to be the translator for the first volume. Originally, three translators were picked for three volumes because they had a very aggressive translation publication schedule, and the only way to get it done in time was to have three people working on it in parallel. Ultimately, the translator they picked originally for book three had to drop out due to other commitments, so I ended up doing book three as well. So that's basically how I got involved. And then I got to work with Tor Books a lot on editing the translation to make it work better for American readers, and the rest is history.
Well, tell me about two things come to mind. One is, I wonder what's the conventional understanding about why it has proved so popular in China? Is it just the time is ripe? Is it the way it's written in such a way that engaged people?
This is a complicated question with no simple answers. If you ask different readers, editors, publishers, authors, they all have their own explanation. I mean, personally, I think the book is extraordinary in terms of the scope of its imagination. I mean, you know, I'm talking about the three books as a whole. It spans the time from the Cultural Revolution and also actually, as you'll find out, from ancient history of the human race, all the way to sort of the end of the universe, literally. The scope of the story, the way that is being sort of packed, all kinds of imaginative, just breathtaking kind of scientific speculation and engineering projects into the three books is just amazing. It's core sci-fi in the classical sense. It's very focused on the romance of the stars and this idea that we need to get out of this rock and go into space, and the way it contemplates ultimate questions about the meaning of existence and life. I think that has a lot of appeal to readers, to be honest, it's not totally clear to anyone why this particular book is the one that broke out of the niche status of sci-fi in China in general. Even the author himself is somewhat confused by it because he's written other novels before and he's a very popular short fiction author, but none of his works have been anywhere nearly as popular as The Three-Body Problem. And even after the success of the series, his other works have not, his previous works have not achieved the same kind of popularity. So there's probably a measure of luck involved. The quality of the book certainly is one of them. But I think ultimately some of the explanation is just never going to be totally clear to people. Sometimes things come together in a way at the right moment with the right book, with the right author, and it just breaks out. And no one can really predict it.
And do you have any sense how it's been doing here in translation?
I don't know the exact numbers because I don't have access to them. But Tor Books have told me that it's doing really well. I believe it sold 20,000 copies relatively quickly after publication. I don't know what the numbers are now. You know, in terms of a book, a translated book by an author with no name recognition in the U.S., it's done extraordinarily well.
Well, let's talk about the challenges of translation. You know, are they mainly about the semantics and word choice, or are they conceptual? Are there cultural concepts that you have to that challenge you in terms of translating them? I wonder where, if there were any stumbling blocks, and what they say about the difference between audiences and cultures.
That's a very difficult question to answer succinctly. I will say this. There were multiple kinds of challenges I anticipated, and the real challenges that came about during translation were totally different. I thought initially that trying to translate the physics jargon would be difficult. And so I lined up all sorts of scientific consultants to help me. I got my friends who are physicists, my uncle who's a bona fide high energy physics researcher, and all sorts of people to help me out. It turns out that part was actually the least difficult part because, as you might imagine, the language of science is fairly uniform, actually, because in most other languages like Chinese, they really just translate directly from English to form the jargon. So something like traveling wave maser in Chinese is just the literal translation of each individual word. So translating it back, that sort of thing is very easy to do. The only thing I needed to do is sometimes I needed to rewrite the scientific explanations a little bit for ease of understanding. And sometimes the math and the science involving the book when it was written in 2006 and between when I did the translation had changed. You know, there are new discoveries and new papers published. So I found those papers and I said, okay, you know, I talked to the author and I said, you know, the conclusion here might need to be modified a little bit because we've learned more information. So we need to say something different here. And the author and I worked together to come up with a new way of explaining these things or updating the research, that sort of thing. I mean, that was time consuming, but it was sort of fun and enjoyable, not particularly challenging because I enjoy reading scientific papers and doing all these astrophysics and math updates are just perfectly fun. The harder challenges come from the cultural issues. There are a lot of cultural assumptions that different people have that are not obvious until you try to translate something and then you realize that it doesn't work because the target audience don't share the same kind of assumptions. I mean, for example, one particular section of the three-body problem involves using Chinese historical figures in a video game to represent a debate about the advent of a rational, knowable view of the universe. The Chinese figures are well known to a Chinese audience. They're important philosophers and important historical figures, but they are not really known to the American audience. So if I just translate the names directly, a lot of the resonances and the meanings are sort of lost. And yet there wasn't really a good way to do it. I mean, I can't just go in and start substituting in quote-unquote equivalent Western figures for these debates because the video game is a deliberate melding of Western and Eastern traditions. And to sort of take the Chinese stuff out of there would not really work. It would not be an accurate representation of the original. And at the same time, I can't just go in there and start adding an encyclopedia-like article about the background of these characters. That's just not the sort of thing I think readers would tolerate. So I ended up having to compromise a little bit. I added small footnotes to give readers sort of a bare hint of who these people were and why they were important. And since we live in the age of Wikipedia, a reader who's interested would at least be able to look up the names and find out more if they wish to. And then I tried to elaborate on the explanations a little bit here and there to make the point clear to a Western reader who has no historical background. So that sort of thing was very challenging because the cultural assumptions and cultural background knowledge being different between different reader communities makes a work difficult to translate directly from one language to another.
And it's also set in the Chinese history that it refers to. I mean, the three-body problem, as you say, opens in the Cultural Revolution, which clearly impacts the psychology of the initial characters who are introduced. I mean, there's a main character who sees, her father horribly abused, and then you know, that sort of sets up a lot of her motivations. But I guess that's sort of almost self-explanatory. I mean, people can understand or imagine, and yet it feels very particular to the Chinese recent history.
I think that's both true and not true, and I'll explain this a little bit. I mean, certainly it's possible to read the Three Body Problem as a particularly Chinese work in the sense of the Cultural Revolution being a very important part of the motivation of the characters. Some of the decisions that Ye Wenjie, the main character, makes would not make sense without the Cultural Revolution as background. But at the same time, I don't think it's necessary or actually helpful to treat that aspect of it as sort of a uniquely Chinese thing. The Cultural Revolution is actually used as a representation, in my view, of this irrational aspect of human nature. The Cultural Revolution might be a particularly bloody and difficult episode in human history, but it's not the only episode of that sort. The French Revolution, certainly, and other kind of eras of revolutionary fervor, zeal, and excess are relevant and are things that we should think about in the context of this sort of thing. There's obviously a larger metaphor being made in the book about these periods, these alternating periods of chaos and stability in the life cycle of the Trisolarans, the aliens, versus the same kind of cycles of violence in human history. And the violence obviously isn't limited only to the Cultural Revolution. It's sort of a hallmark of human progress across the world throughout history. And I think that is a much more interesting and useful way to think about why the Cultural Revolution features so prominently at the beginning.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I thought it was fascinating that in the context of the Cultural Revolution, it seemed, or maybe it was already passing, there was criticism within the science community, or maybe it was the government imposing itself on the scientific community to reject, you know, Einsteinian, you know, worldview, you know, general relativity and such as like Western ideology, and that it couldn't be true. And yet the next generation, of course, all those the ideas return and are embraced. I mean, the book itself now, it presenting the current state as it does in the chronology and the Three Body Problem, there is a universal understanding of science. It's not everyone working together. In other words, Earthlings unified in their understanding of science, whereas at the beginning of the book, there seems to be this divide.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, the book, I think, is unabashedly pro-science, pro-rationality. I mean, the entire point of the book is that the universe is knowable, rationally knowable, and that that is the only way to make forward progress and to actually elevate the human race. But, you know, at the same time, you know, just to clarify a little bit, the debate isn't so much over whether something is quote unquote Western or not. The way the Cultural Revolution was set up, it wasn't even really the government. I mean, it's arguable what was the government during the Cultural Revolution. The entire period was one where, in essence, factions within the government, if you will, were fighting out an ideological struggle using by invoking forces of irrationality in society and joining in this very violent period of destruction. And it's not so much, you know, Western ideology versus something not Western, because the very thing they used to critique Einsteinian relativity is, you know, Marxism and dialectics, which are also Western ideas. So it's really about, you know, what is rationality and what is a scientific way of view of the universe. And the struggle at the beginning, I think, is better understood as just forces of stability and rationality and progress versus forces of irrationality and violence and power for the sake of power. And these are the opposing camps being presented in the Cultural Revolution. The idea here is that the main characters were shaped by this background and pursues through rational methods and ultimately irrational decision.
One of the things that I found really kind of compelling and surprising about the story was the large group of people who, you know, the way the story is set up, there are aliens who are interested in ultimately coming to the Earth and taking over. And there are a group of people who let the aliens know that the Earth exists and try to aid them and are happy that they're going to come and destroy human civilization because they're tired of it. They think the humans have ruined the Earth and that human civilization should be destroyed. And I guess I found that interesting because usually the trope in science fiction is that that's the one thing that unites all humans is an alien invasion. You know,
I want to say something about that too. I've heard a lot of readers find that aspect of it not believable or find it really strange. And I have to say, I'm a little baffled by why readers react that way, and I'll explain why. I think if you've studied the history of colonialism and the way colonial struggles have happened, it's complicated. The idea of collaboration with an outside invader in the hopes of utterly destroying local institutions and local elites and local power structures, because the collaborationists want to simply do better, or because they truly believe that the outside invaders represent saviors of some sort, is not a new idea. This kind of thing happens in the history of colonialism all over the place. So it may be that because most American readers have not had an intimate experience or historical experience of being a subject people who are invaded and conquered by outside forces, or who have lived under a system which is falling apart and corrupt and unable to resist outside forces in some way, that they find this idea really strange. But it's not really very strange. If you look at history, this kind of collaborationism is fairly common.
I found it surprising because most people wouldn't, you know, it seems to be easier just to imagine everyone uniting. But I think I found it plausible, not for the reasons you're saying, although what you're saying makes a lot of sense. I was thinking that people look at what we've done to the Earth and the environment and the strife and kind of like a Noah's Ark, you know, like, hey, you know, maybe it's time for the gods to come down and erase what's here and start over, you know, maybe.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think that's actually that kind of disgust with the existing system and the belief that a technologically superior people would also be morally superior. I think is not all that strange. I mean, I don't know if that sort of idea is represented in Western classical science fiction either, but I can't imagine that's a trope that has never been done before. The idea that, you know, these technologically superior beings are also morally superior to us, and in fact, we need them to reform us and to just give us a fresh new start of some sort. I can't imagine that has not been done before.
That's true. Everything's probably been done before at some point. So
I know that's what you find out once you've studied the field deeply enough.
Well, let's move on to The Grace of Kings, which is, you know, a very different book and a different genre, I guess, if it's the fantasy genre. And I think it's really interesting that you can go from translating and becoming an expert, really, as you say, reading scientific papers and being very interested in the science underlying the three-body problem, and then go into a very different kind of storytelling with fantastical creatures and inventions and emperors. Tell me a little bit about, you know, where your interests go in your writing and what the connective tissue is here.
Right. Okay. So The Grace of Kings is ultimately if you boil it down to it, a reimagining of a Chinese historical romance, and specifically a set of legends and historical facts around the fall of the Qing Dynasty and the rise of the Han Dynasty around 200 BC, into the format of a contemporary epic fantasy. And the reason I did it this way is because my wife and I both grew up in Chinese-speaking countries where these historical romances are sort of a very fundamental part of the way we learn what narrative is and what story is. You know, every culture has its own set of foundational narratives that are echoed and dialogued with and reimagined over and over again. You know, so for us in the West, it would be something like the Iliad and the Odyssey and Paradise Lost and Beowulf and the Aeneid and all of these foundational narratives of Western culture. They're stories about how a people embody their own values and how a people sort of see themselves as having meaning in the universe. And modern works, no matter, you know, how they're done, echo these foundational narratives in some way, because these foundational narratives form the very substructure of how we understand and perceive storytelling. In China, the same sort of role is played by historical romances and historical legends. So something like Romance of the Three Kingdoms or the Chu Han Contention, which is the source of The Grace of Kings, play the same sort of role. These are stories that have been told and retold in many different ways, in poetry, in folk opera, in TV drama series, in martial arts novels, and so on and so forth. And so I wanted to do something interesting, which is to take one of these foundational narratives from Chinese culture and then try to reimagine it using the literary tropes and techniques of another set of traditions. And so The Grace of Kings reimagines this set of historical legends using a secondary world archipelago setting where, you know, things are not China and the people are not Chinese and the languages and culture are not superficially East Asian in any way. But everything is, in a foundational sense, inspired by that source narrative. And then I use storytelling techniques that are melding from classical Chinese traditions as well as Western traditions that I've inherited. And so the result is sort of this melding of everything into this very fantastical universe that I call silk punk. And the idea here is that instead of being like steampunk, which is inspired by Victorian technology and aesthetics, this is a set of a technology vocabulary and aesthetics inspired by Chinese and East Asian antiquity. So there are battle kites, and mechanical contraptions of various sorts. There are underwater boats. There are airships that propel themselves through the air using giant feathered oars. Everything has this very cool sheen that represents the kind of machines and inventions you see in Chinese block prints and in old Chinese historical romances, but sort of blown up all the way to past 11 and extended into a new technology vocabulary that I had a lot of fun playing with. So, you know, in some sense, you can sort of view The Grace of Kings as kind of a epic fantasy slash science fiction novel, just the same way that a lot of steampunk is a mixture of fantasy and science fiction. I spent a lot of energy working out the technologies and seeing how bamboo, paper, feathers, coconut, and all these organic materials of historical importance to East Asia and to the seafaring cultures of the Pacific can be used to build these very immense, powerful contraptions that transform the way we think about how life can be in such a world. Anyway, so I had a lot of fun doing stuff like that, but I also add a lot of magic to it, and I wanted to embody some of the attitudes that are very natural to me as a culturally Chinese person, but that may be fresh and interesting to a Western audience not familiar with them. So, for example, the gods are not revered, but instead they can be tricked and played with. And that's a very old trope in Chinese culture, that the gods are not these omniscient and omnipotent beings. Rather, they are basically just beings at a higher plane of existence, but who are subject to the same kind of manipulation as people. Yeah,
and
that's the idea.
And the way the book is written too, it has if I do say so, it felt like it had a very different rhythm that made it very interesting and made it unexpected as I turned the page, because you would, you know, pause over a conversation or a scene, but then at times very quickly pass over, you know, what might be, you know, a decade or two of development in an empire or something. And so it was sort of like, I kind of didn't know where it would go next. And the information, I mean, it was very engaging when you'd stop and pause and then you'd jump ahead to another moment like that. And it gave it this very epic quality, and yet it felt different. It felt like a different kind of storytelling to me.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think though it's marketed as epic fantasy, it's not very similar to contemporary epic fantasy. It uses some of the tropes from there, but I would say it's closer to an epic poem told in the style of a novel. And a lot of the narrative techniques I use would be more familiar to people whose reference works are like, you know, the Aeneid or Romance of the Three Kingdoms or something like that. It has a much more... a lot of the narrative techniques and the way point of view is handled should be reminiscent of much older works, even though the sensibility is very modern. It's a deliberate, interesting meld. But I think if you go in there expecting a traditional epic fantasy, you might be a little shocked until you get used to it and then figure out what it is I'm doing.
And so do you want to just say a little bit about what the story is, just so people give them a taste of like what's
happening? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, we should start with that, actually. So the Grace of Kings is about an empire that recently united the disparate islands of Dara. And the empire is efficient, but not particularly well run. And the rule is very harsh. And so this encourages rebellion. And two individuals who seem like polar opposites, one of them is Kunigaru, who is a commoner and does not seem to have a lot of ambition. And the other one is Matazindu, who is the son of a duke who has been deposed during the unification and who has always yearned to return to his family, to that place of glory, and to return the world to the way it used to be before the empire came and messed everything up. So Kuni and Mata become two leaders in the rebellion. And even though they have such different personalities and different strengths and weaknesses, they end up becoming really good friends and complement each other in the struggle against the empire. But the problem is, just as they're about to succeed, this pair of spiritual brothers find themselves at odds because they have very different visions about how a more just world ought to be constructed. Kuni wants to see revolution and change and push forward something that the empire only hints at, whereas Mata wants everything to return to the way it used to be, to a golden age that might never have been. And so that's kind of the overall arc and framework for the story.
And do you have a particular, I know it's not meant to be didactic, but what's your feeling about, without revealing too much, like what makes the best leader? Like what, I mean, there's clearly an evil emperor who sets out in the beginning to, who unifies this world, but is very draconian and very grandiose and, you know, doesn't care about his people. And that's clearly not a model to follow, but... Are there other ideas about leadership and power that you're exploring here?
Yeah, it's going to be worked out throughout the series. The arc for the series as a whole follows the idea of punk. You know, I mean, I call it silk punk, not just because there's a lot of East Asian technology sort of thing in there, but because the overall aesthetic of the book is pro-revolution, pro-change. And so the idea of dynamism, of evolving, of responding to changed circumstances, technologically, economically, and demographically is going to be important. This is not a book wherein the goal is to return to a golden age, a status quo ante, some glorious, wonderful, idealized past that never really was. This is a book about, you know, how do you change? Things have changed. We can't go back. So how do you change? And the idea of kingship and also being a ruler and perhaps sharing power and even some measure of decentralization are going to come into play. You know, I can't give everything away, but the idea of change overall is what drives the book and the series.
And so when is the next book? Now, the series is called The Dandelion Dynasty.
Dynasty, that's right.
And when is the next installment?
The next installment is scheduled to come out next year, probably middle of the year or maybe later.
And are you still writing it?
I have most of it done. I'm in the stage now of revising, going back. You know how it is. I mean, the first book took me 4 years to write, and that thing must have gone through dozens of drafts. I don't think a single sentence from the first draft has survived into the published version. The second book is you know, going through the whole revision, rewriting process now. But you know, I'm pretty excited by it. I think it's better than the first book, and I hope readers like it.
Well, great. And just give me a little insight into how you manage all these different projects. I mean, you're translating, you're writing your own books, you're writing short stories, which is what you've won so many awards for. Do you jump from one thing to another in the course of a day? Do you set aside a week at a time to work on one project and then move to another? Or?
I have to say I can't possibly claim to be that super organized. The short story thing was where I put most of my creative energy during the previous years, but I've basically stopped writing short fiction now. I mean, there are once in a while some sort of anthology invitation that's super interesting, I might do it, but other than that, I'm not writing short fiction on spec anymore. So that sort of clears that part up. Otherwise, I wouldn't have the ability to do any of this. I pretty much have to do things one at a time. I mean, when I was translating The Three Body Problem, I put aside basically, you know, 6-7 months of my life doing nothing but translating that book. It was extremely, extremely draining. And translating book three was even more. It took a lot out of me. So, you know, unless it's a really compelling novel, I wouldn't do it again. You know, I did it because I really admire the work. And I think the author, Liu Cixin, is one of those rare talents who can recover the imaginative sensibility and the scope of one of those classic Arthur C. Clarke type of novels, but tell it in a really interesting contemporary kind of setting. But you know, short of some amazing work like that, I wouldn't do another big novel translation project again. I have to focus on my own novels, and these are very, very time consuming. I basically do all the writing because I have a day job and have young children at home. I have to do the writing basically during commutes between home and work on the train.
Wow.
So the novel is written in these short little chunks, which explains why a lot of revision has to happen, because there are things that are just very disjointed when you write like this. And so I have to go back and do a lot of revising and smoothing out.
And do you use a laptop or you use longhand?
I have a laptop. Thank God I do not writing longhand anymore. But back when I used to take notes in college by paper and pencil, after like a couple of days, I wouldn't be able to read what I wrote. So thankfully those days are over. My handwriting is so atrocious.
Well, and you also have a collection of short stories that's going to be published soon. Is that?
I do. Saga Press, my publisher, which is an imprint of Simon Schuster, is putting out a collection of my short fiction called The Paper Menagerie and Other Stories this October, I think, or November. I can't remember exactly, but it's late in the year. And I'm super excited. This will be my first collection. And it sort of collects what Joe Mounty, my editor, and I thought were the works that were most representative of my short fiction career. So it's kind of a really exciting thing to have it all in one place.
Wow. Well, great. So you've got it. Eventually, the third book of The Three Body Problem that you translated will be coming out, your second book in the Dandelion Dynasty series, and your collection of short stories at the end of the year. So that's pretty amazing.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, I'm super excited.
Congratulations on all of that. And I really appreciate your taking the time to chat with me.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, I've been talking with Ken Liu about his novel, The Grace of Kings, and the novel by Tsu-Chin Liu, The Three Body Problem, which Ken translated. You can listen to more podcasts at www.newbooksinsciencefiction.com. You can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcasting apps. You can also find New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy on Facebook and on Twitter at New Books Sci-Fi. And you can also follow me, Rob Wolf, at Rob Wolf Books. Our logo is by Michael Thibodeau, theme music by Michael Aaron, and the editor of the New Books Network is Marshall Poe. And next month, I'll be speaking with Meg Ellison, who wrote this year's Philip K. Dick Award winner, The Book of the Unnamed Midwife. So be sure to have a listen. Bye for now, and thanks for listening.